The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Variety Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericavariety.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
We're so glad you've stopped by. Welcome to Around the World in a Glass, presented by Sportsman's with your host, Kimber Stonehouse. Come indulge with us in the next hour as we explore our region of the world, its wine and spirits. We'll also talk about food, tours, and other amenities unique to this area. Sit back and enjoy. Now, here's Kimber Stonehouse.
Well, welcome back this week to Around the World in a Glass. We are going to have some fun today talking about one of my favorite wine regions, one of them that we haven't spent a lot of time on yet. It's actually right here in the States. You know, I kind of like the import wines, so this will be a little different. We'll focus on one that's outside of my norm and stay in the States. Did everybody have a good Thanksgiving? I'm hoping you did. My wine that I chose to have went fantastic with the food that I was having. So, you know, that was always a good thing. I did the Pacific Rim Gewürztraminer at my house, and my guests were quite thrilled. They thought it was fantastic, and that it went very well with our food. We did ham, not turkey, at my house. We're kind of anti-turkey people. So anyway, my Thanksgiving was fantastic. I hope that yours was too. And I don't know about anybody else, but I've been kind of fighting the food coma for about a week now, trying to figure out, you know, a little bit lighter food to eat, at least for the next couple of weeks until the next round of holiday gets here. Because, you know, we have that next one coming up in you know, not very long. Some of these wines that we're going to talk about today are going to make great gifts. I know people are starting to worry about that. So I'm going to hit some things that are kind of on the high side. That doesn't mean that you can't find things less expensive, but some of my favorites are on the more expensive side. So I guess without teasing you any further, we're going to talk about Oregon wines, that state up there that is known for being south of Starbucks and north of Napa Valley. You know, that one right there in the middle. They have a wonderful city, from what I'm told, named Portland in Oregon. But we're going to talk about the wine regions. There's just a few of them we're going to focus on today. And the biggest one we're going to focus on is Willamette. And you may have seen it on labels, and it looks like Willamette. But it is, I believe it's an Indian word, or it's based on an Indian word, and it's Willamette. So the emphasis is kind of there in the middle. I don't care how you say it. You just want to buy the wines from that region because they're really good. There's a couple regions south of that that we're going to mention in passing, but I'm probably not going to spend as much time there. There's Rogue Valley, which is the farthest one south. And then there's Umpqua, U-M-Q-U-A. My guess is we're still sticking with the Indian words there. Native American maybe is the maybe proper way to say that. But, the you know, Umpqua is not exactly what I would consider to be a word in the English language. And it's another valley. Willamette Valley runs alongside, the valley is created by the river. And so the grapes are grown on both sides of that valley. There's two other regions that are completely different than those three. Those three are cold, cool, maybe not always cold, but cool. They fight frost in the spring and in the fall. They, get a decent amount of rain, but not nearly as much rain as, say, Chicago. So they don't always get enough rain, or they get the rain at the wrong time. They also fight enough sunshine because they get a decent amount of rain. Sometimes they don't get any sunshine. So the grapes, sometimes they ripen nice and slow and very, very casually, as opposed to the wines, say, in California that ripen very quickly because of all the sunshine, or here in Phoenix where we have to worry about actually scorching the grapes because we have so much sunshine. In Oregon, they're constantly fretting over the whether the grapes will ripen or not. And when they do ripen, will they be lush enough? Will they be rich enough to produce good wine? So they fight sunshine, they fight frost, they fight – I don't know that they fight a lot of wind, but I think they have some wind. Not like Burgundy, though, that has much – bigger problems with the wind. So it's not an ideal place to grow the grapes at all. So it's, you know, so that's those three valley areas, Umpqua, Rogue, and the big one, Willamette. If you go farther up along the coast of the state of Washington, there are two appellations that are in Washington State and Oregon. And those would be the one in Washington. There's two of them, Columbia Valley, which kind of eases over into Oregon. And then there's also Walla Walla. And those two areas are much warmer and lighter, you know, sunnier and hotter. And then they grow your more traditional grapes, your Cabernets and Merlots and your warm climate grapes, as well as some of your Rieslings, which can be kind of sweeter when they're grown in a warmer climate. They can be much sweeter. So we're going to focus on the Oregon parts. We're going to talk a little bit about those two that kind of sit on the fence, because almost all wineries, not all, but several wineries, all right, have property in both areas. So they focus on one type of grapes in the Willamette Valley and those other two valleys south of the Willamette. And then when they go up into the northern area of the state, up along the eastern side of Washington State, where they kind of overlap, they'll focus more on the warmer grape varietals like Cabernet and Merlot for those grapes up there, because it's more sunshine, it's warmer. You got to use a warmer climate grape. You had no idea, right, when you turned on the radio today that we were going to talk about warm and cold climate grapes, because I haven't quite delved into that a whole lot. But I think it's time to start broadening your interests and kind of moving in a little more complex on some of these wines. All right, so several years ago, a movie came out, about 10 years ago, a movie came out that just trashed Merlot, all right, as a wine. Just the entire movie, I think some people, that's all they took away from the movie, was that Merlot was awful. Well, and that the primary character in the movie wasn't going to drink any Merlot. Well, he was more emphatic than that, but we won't say that on the air. But he wasn't drinking Merlot. The thing is that movie did a couple of things. One, it got Merlot to clean up its act a little bit, because Merlot, especially here in the States, but I assume everywhere would be very similar to the States, we were producing a whole lot of Merlot that wasn't really very good. We were producing a lot of very mediocre to, let's just say what it was, it was poor quality. It didn't cost much money, but it wasn't very good either. So we were producing a lot of really poor quality Merlot, a lot of substandard wine that just, you know, take a little pride and spend a little more quality. So what this movie did, it had a couple of fold effect, and I'm going to tell you the movie, I promise. This movie kind of woke up the Merlot area and said, hey, you want people to buy your stuff? Then make a quality product. The movie also promoted a different grape, because it's what he said was so divine. And they were not in Oregon in this movie, by the way. They were in California, Central Coast area. But he was promoting the wines of Pinot Noir. Pinot Noir. Oh, and the beauty of the Pinot Noir. All right, so that's the grape that we are going to focus on today, only we're not going to do it in California. We're going to do it in Oregon, because that's what has made Oregon, that's what's put them on the map, has been their Pinot Noir. They grow a few other things there, and they're white, actually, so that'll be some Chardonnay. They do a little bit of Riesling, but their big favorite white grape that's up and coming is Pinot Gris. And if you notice, it's a Pinot Noir, Pinot Gris, right? Well, one Pinot Noir is Pinot Black, so it's a black grape, red grape, but it's really, really dark in color. And Pinot Gris actually means that it's Pinot Gray. So gray as in the color. Gris means gray in Italian or German one. So they are related, all right? Pinot Noir is the grape that is known for having the most, not clones. Forgotten the word. Anyway, it changes the most. Genetic modifications. It changes itself. It's constantly modifying to its new environment. Constantly changes. So it's known as the one that does that the most out of all of them. And I could have swore it would be Sangiovese, because there's, I don't know how many different versions of the Sangiovese grape in Italy. But Pinot Noir is known to be the one that continually grows and modifies itself and changes its genetic structure and becomes something slightly different. It's known to do that with almost no encouragement. So if it's growing along there in Oregon for 10 years and it decides one year that, you know, thinks it would feel better if it worked this way in the soil, well, then it'll change it. It'll kind of adapt to the soil and create something slightly different. Gamay that we have talked about before, that's grown in the Beaujolais region of France, which is south of the southern area, I believe, of Burgundy. That is an ancestor of Pinot Noir. So it's one of the many of the mutations. There we go. That's that word. One of those mutations that's even earlier would be it's an ancestor of Pinot Noir. So then it became Pinot Noir, what we call Pinot Noir now, and then Pinot Gris and Pinot Blanc. Pinot Gris and Pinot Grigio are the same grape. All right. Pinot Gris is usually what it's called in the States. Pinot Grigio is what it's called in Italy. So, and some people like one and not the other. All right. I had a woman in the store this last week. She was like, but I don't like Pinot Gris. I don't like them from the States. And I'm like, okay, let's get you some Pinot Grigio. They're still the same grape. But, you know, soil makes a difference. The rain quantity makes a difference. The way the vintner does that, you know, treats them when they're in the field, and then how they process them when they get them into the winery. All those things create differences in flavor profile. And then there's people like me who really don't like Pinot Gris very well at all. So that movie came out, and it did a few things. The movie was called Sideways. So if you've not seen it, I thought everybody that ever had any interest in the wine would have seen it by now. But if you have not seen it, it used to be available like on Netflix for downloading. You can find it just about anywhere to download and rent. And it's well worth watching. If you've seen the movie, you'll understand. There's some really not very nice people in it. All right. But the wine part is very cool. It's just awesome. And at the very end of the movie, he's drinking a bottle of wine that he has aged and kept forever. You know, he's kept it many years, and it's always been the bottle that he's going to drink at the perfect moment, at this special occasion. And in the end, he finally decides, you know, to drink this wine. I'm not going to tell you the rest. Anyway, he's bashed Merlot the entire movie, and the bottle he chooses to drink is almost 100% Merlot. It's a very high percentage of Merlot. So it's really, you know, so that's kind of, you know, the part that non-wine drinkers miss out on when they get to the end, or people who don't know that bottle of wine. When you get to the end, the wine he drinks at the end of the movie is actually Merlot-based. So you might not want to drink Merlot unless it's, you know, a quality Merlot is kind of what I took out from part of that movie. But anyway, what it did do was it introduced the world to Pinot Noir. And Pinot Noir is an amazing grape, and we talked about it when we talked about, I think we spent maybe an entire episode on Pinot Noir over the summer. We talked about it in Burgundy and some in Oregon and California and Russian River. And today we're going to focus on the wines coming out of Oregon and how they are so special. As I was doing my brush-up research, I found a few funny little anecdotes, things, just funny little things that I wanted to share with you today. One of them was the two people who kind of jump-started the wine industry in Oregon, okay? There was probably a few little random, maybe church-based wineries pre-prohibition, all right? But nobody was trying to grow grapes there. It was terrible. You know, it was not the right place to grow wine grapes. Period. End of discussion. Don't even try it. All right, so there were, you know, that had gone on, but the real time that it really started to take off in Oregon, believe it or not, was about 1961. And there was a gentleman there. He was a graduate from the University of California at Davis. And he planted some Riesling. All right, probably not going to grow well there, but he planted it anyway. And 5 years later, another UC Davis graduate came up, and he said, I'm going to plant some Pinot Noir and called it Erie Vineyards, E-Y-R-I-E, Vineyards. And he did it in Willamette, all right? So one did it in Umpqua, which is just south of Willamette, and one did it in Willamette. And they're going to plant, they plant Riesling and Pinot Noir. And they were both told by the university professors that the vinifera grapes, which is what wine grapes are, they're called vinifera, V-I-N-I-F-E-R-A, vinifera, they are not going to grow very well in Oregon. So basically they were told, well, from the time they planted the grapes, you're going to fail. These aren't going to grow very well, and they're not going to make good wine, and you're wasting your time and your money. But, you know, isn't it always awesome when you kind of just ignore somebody who thinks they know everything? And the wine industry in Oregon was born through those two. All right. Yeah, and I thought that was the coolest thing. I'm like, so they were flat out told, this is a bad idea. You're wasting your time and your money. They did it anyway. And thankfully they did, because between 1961 and 1966 is when the wine industry in Oregon was actually, you know, started. And since then, many other people have come and planted specifically Pinot Noir, some Chardonnay, and the growing and more exciting Pinot Gris category. Now there are, I don't know, somewhere well over 138 different wineries that are up in the state of Oregon, and many of them are going to be in the Willamette. I mean, you go down through Willamette. I haven't been there, so I'm sorry. I don't know all the detail. I don't know all of it, the ins and outs places to really check out. I just know where I like what I like to drink, and then I know where some of them are. I mean, there some of them are across the street from each other. So, you know, you're looking at your little Oregon Willamette Valley map, and you've got, you know, Van Duzer over here, and their neighbor is, you know, Witness Tree. You know, so they're, it's not very big. Like most wine regions, you know, you're talking not a whole lot of miles. It's just small little sections, you know. I mean, when we talked about Bordeaux and Burgundy, you know, you find out how far that is from top to bottom, and you're like, wow. And they have such a huge reputation and charge so much for some of those wines. Same thing with, you know, Oregon. It's not a huge amount of land. You've got good land, and you've got more land than you probably have, like, in some of the European states and countries. But, you know, there's not a ton of space. You've got your opportunity, and Willamette Valley is that specific valley alongside the river. And you've got your property there, and then, you know, the farther you get away from that river and that valley area, the more detrimental the climate is going to get. All right, so everybody grows Pinot Noir. That's kind of what everything I read said. Everybody grows Pinot Noir. But they grow those other two grapes. And we are going to talk about that, because I think that Chardonnay from Willamette Valley is some of my favorite Chardonnay. We have two or three different brands that we carry at the store. I'm going to be straight up honest with you. They're going to be expensive. All right? You know what I like to spend on my wine. All right. I'm very honest with you. I tell you that I usually spend between $15 and $20 to $25 a bottle. Sometimes I don't even spend that. Sometimes I find a smoking deal and it's $10. And you know what? If it's a good $10, I'll take it home and drink it. So I don't often spend over $50 on a bottle of wine. And I have to be honest, I haven't often spent over $50 on a bottle of wine for these Oregon Chardonnays either. But they are fantastic. And they are worth every penny. They're some of my favorites. And I'm going to get into why, I promise, because I think you need to know why it is that all of a sudden this kind of non-Chardonnay drinker is raving about Oregon Chardonnay, and there's a reason for that. All right, so they decide not to pay any attention to the powers that be and all the brilliant university professors. They plant their grapes, and then they kind of sit back and wait and just kind of start making wine. Now, we've talked before about how long it takes to get a good crop. And, you know, you're looking at a minimum of 3 years where you don't make any wine. You don't even think about making any wine. You take the grapes off and you throw them on the ground to fertilize next year's batch. I mean, all you're doing is you're manning the vines, you're pruning, you're taking care of your crop, you're making sure it gets the water it needs, you're, you know, changing things around as you need to, you're letting the vines grow and develop and you know, setting up your what they call the canopies of the grapes, which is all the vines, right? Because grapes are a vine, and so they vine everywhere, kind of like philodendrons vine everywhere, right? And you can either let them just wander everywhere, or you can, you know, make them go around little metal things or whatever that you want to do with your plants in the house. But when you're working with vinifera grapes, you want to keep the vines out of the way of the grapes so that the grape clusters can also get plenty of sunshine. So you want to make sure that you're keeping your vines off of part of your grapes and keeping it, you know, managing that canopy so that it doesn't hinder the growth of those grapes. Because the grapes is what you're trying to grow. The canopy can be great, but, you know, that's leaves. And for the most part, the leaves don't drink very well. What we want to drink is the pressed juice off of the grapes that we're going to ferment into the wine. So that's a real important piece of it there, is to make sure that the canopy is taken care of. So those are the things that you do those first 3 years. And then maybe after 3 years, you might get some grapes that are going to press into good wine. And, you know, and so then you're looking at least at 3 or 4 years before you're going to actually have any product to sell. So it's an investment. Investment of time, an investment of money, an investment of labor, and no guarantees. All right? So with that thought, ponder that for just a moment. We're going to cut to break, and when we come back, I'm going to give you some brand names and some reasons why I love these wines so very much that I'll even fork out $50 or $60 on an occasion to buy myself a bottle. We'll be right back.
News, opinion, your voice counts. Call toll free 1-866-472-5787. 1-866-472-5787. VoiceAmerica.com.
Tune in to the Voice America Variety channel on the Voice America Talk Radio Network. Voice America Variety broadcasts a diverse array of topics, reaching a global community. Our experts come from all walks of life, and the topics they discuss are everything from current events, arts and entertainment, leadership, parenting, relationships, self-improvement, career advice, and a variety of other topics. Check us out today. You're sure to find something of interest. Voice America Variety. Talk on today's hot topics.
On the weekends, you like to relax with your girlfriends, a cup of tea, your favorite magazine, and some stories and fun. So why not check out Sisters Seriously? It's all that and a whole lot more. Host Kelly Chevalier and her guests will bring you stories and tips designed to encourage women everywhere. Find out more about fashion, interior design, beauty, and entertaining. Sure, we make mistakes like everyone else, but the goal is to find out how to overcome and live the fabulous life for free. Sisters Seriously is live every Saturday at 10 a.m. Eastern, 7 a.m. Pacific on Voice America Variety.
The Internet's number one talk station. Number one talk station. VoiceAmerica.com.
You are listening to Around the World in a Glass, presented by Sportsman's, with your host, Kimber Stonehouse. If you have a question for one of our upcoming programs, please send an email to aroundtheworldinaglass@hotmail.com. That's aroundtheworldinaglass@hotmail.com. Now, back to our show.
All right, so a little bit more about some Pinot Noir. It is considered, I didn't quite go to this in the first part, I forgot. It is considered to be the heartbreak grape. Heartbreak. Remember I was talking right before break about how much money and how much time it takes to get even a decent crop. Okay, that goes for any grape. That doesn't matter if you're talking Pinot Noir. That goes for any grape you're going to push in and press and make into wine. Whether it's Riesling or Cab, it doesn't matter where you're growing it either. You could be growing it in Oregon in the Willamette Valley. You could be growing it in California's Napa Valley, which talk about expensive. And you know, or you could be growing it in Central Coast or Finger Lakes, New York. It doesn't matter where you're at. You're going to have at least 3 years go by before you even have a grape that you can, you know, a decent crop of grapes that you can even think about pressing into wine. And then you got to figure, you know, if you're the winemaker, say it's a, you know, you're a one-man show or one-woman show, how good do you think your first ever vintage is going to be? You know, depends on how much help you get, right? So, you know, all of those are considerations. So when you start focusing that all that energy and all that time and money on Pinot Noir, Pinot Noir is known as the heartbreak grape. It is finicky. It's temperamental. It wants perfect sun, perfect weather. Oh, but not too much, because then I get too jammy and too fruity and I don't have any complexity. So it's just a really difficult grape to grow and to grow well. So very few wine regions are going to focus on that grape because it's not a moneymaker, all right? The sun doesn't come out quite enough. You're not like, you know, Annie, and the sun doesn't come out for you tomorrow. And you don't get enough rain, and it doesn't work. And so you have a really lean crop, and you're going to have, you know, wines that are really light in color. And, you know, and it's going to be light and really delicate on the palate. And it can be good on those years, but you're also not going to get very much. And then you have other years where it gets really sunny, say, and The Pinot Noir is really thin-skinned, okay? That's one reason it's so light in color sometimes when it comes into the glass. It's a lighter red, kind of, some people call it kind of a real pale kind of cranberry color. It's really very, very delicate looking sometimes. So Cabernet is a really thick-skinned grape, which is where you get all that tannin and that funky bitterness sometimes people don't like. And you get some of the rich flavor from the grape skins, because remember the seeds and the skins are included in the fermenting process, the pressing and fermenting process. So Pinot Noir is thin-skinned. So some years, if it's too sunny, what happens is the vines get scorched. The grapes get scorched. They get burnt. Before they ever get off the vine, they are destroyed. All right, so the Pinot Noir grape, because it is so delicate, it is so difficult to grow well, most wine regions don't thrive with that grape. It's either the wrong climate, too sunny, too hot, and they don't want to focus on it because it's really hard to focus on something that doesn't always produce a good crop. Right? If you think about, if you have, you know, you and all of your buddies and your whole, say, wine club, right, your wine growers club, all focus on Pinot Noir, and everybody's broke next year because nobody had a decent crop, it just makes it really hard for the entire community to work well together. And so usually people diversify. They don't put all their eggs, so to speak, or grapes, so to speak, in one basket. And you know, not grow a lot on other things that are going to be their what they're known for. But there's only one other region in the world that's known for its Pinot Noir. And you got it. It's France. The Burgundy region of France. They make some of the top Pinot Noir in the world. Just, they're amazing. They have amazing price tags, but they are amazing. And some of the really, really amazing ones with the really, really amazing price tags, I've never had. Nobody's willing to open that up, and I certainly can't pay $1,500 for a bottle of wine. I can't pay $200 for a bottle of wine, except on a very, very rare special bottle that I work an extra job to come up with the money to pay for it, you know, and then I save it for a really special occasion. But I just don't do that. I don't have that in my budget, and I don't want to feel guilty for buying a really great bottle of wine. But some of the really high-end wines coming out of Burgundy are going to cost $300, $400, $600, $800, $1,500. The wines in Oregon, I'm happy to tell you, don't cost that much. They are more than what I normally spend, but they don't cost that much. So this really cool thing happened in Oregon and France. So in about 79, this French publisher decided, hey, let's have a little contest, and let's sponsor this wine contest. And 600 wines came from 33 different wine regions in the world, all right? And Airy Vineyard, remember, he's the first one who planted Pinot Noir, E-Y-R-I-E. He's the first one who planted the Pinot Noir, was told, this ain't going to grow here, just so you know. You're wasting your time and money. It's not going to work. So he decided he was going to send his Pinot Noir to compete at this French publication wine competition. Yeah, you know where this is going, right? We've talked about the Judgment of Paris in 1976, where a couple of really fantastic Napa wines won on the world stage and beat out some French wines. Pretty cool, right? So anyway, 1975... his Pinot from that vintage, 1975 vintage, placed third in this competition against other Pinot Noirs. In fact, against French Burgundy. That's right. He placed third. All right. Everybody said, you know what? That was just a fluke. That is not accurate. They were stunned, but nobody really believed that it was accurate. They think it was just a weird thing. Maybe he had a really great bottle and the other bottles were just kind of off. You know, maybe it wasn't, people just weren't convinced. It did happen in France, and they are known for their Burgundy. They do the best in the world for Pinot Noir. So you can understand that they're thinking, oh, these young upstarts, they don't have a clue. They've only been in the wine industry for, 15 years. 1965, this is their 10th vintage. Maybe. 10th year since they planted the grapes, even. That this was just, it can't be an accurate sampling. It just can't be. So anyway, 1980, Robert Drouin, which he is, Drouin wines are fantastic. It's a leading Burgundian vintner. All right. He does wine there, and they're Domaine Drouin. They're fantastic. You're not going to go wrong. And some of them are affordable. They do some inexpensive ones. One of their Pinots out of Burgundy is called Vero, V-E-R-O. I want to say it runs $20. Might run only $18. So, you know, it's not a bad price for French Burgundy. And it's a nice place to get started. It's what I call American palate friendly. So it's not as austere as some of the Burgundies. It's still got a lot of good fruit. So it's a good place to start. But anyway, that's one of his wines. That's one of his owner things that he owns. He decided in 1980 to have a rematch. And this time, he's going to do it with Burgundy itself. So he's going to put up those Oregon Pinots straight up against Red Burgundy. Airy came in second. You heard me right. They came in second this time. So 5 years later, and they come in second, not third. All right. So the best part about the whole story is that in 1987, Drouin bought land near the Airy Vineyard and started Domaine Drouin. We call it DDO, Domaine Drouin, Oregon. So they're out there in Oregon now. They do some amazing wines in Oregon, and they're not inexpensive. They're still going to be $30-$40. I think the Domaine Drouin, we call it DDO, Domaine Drouin, Oregon, just the regular one is, I want to say, in its mid-30s, might be low 40s. And then they do one called Lorraine, and it is just fabulous. And Drouin isn't the only one. There's been a few of them that have property in Burgundy that have bought up some land, not a lot, but some land, to do grapes in Oregon because they just see that the Pinot Noir grape is that good in Oregon. So I just thought that was the coolest thing when I read those two different bits this week. And because I knew Domaine Drouin was in both places. I didn't realize that he had done that competition against Red Burgundy. So that's definitely one of my favorites. They do some Chardonnays, too, but they had use a little bit heavier hand on the domestic ones with the oak. Drouin, even on the ones that are from Burgundy, they use a little bit heavier hand on the oak than some of the other ones that I like. So I don't love the Chardonnay as much. They're good. No argument there. They're good, whether you're buying the Oregon Chardonnays or whether you're buying the ones from Burgundy, France. Though they're fantastic. If you poured it in a glass, I'm going to drink it. But as far as buying it and taking it home, I'm not as comfortable buying it and taking it home because they're just a little heavy. I like my Chardonnay to be a lot lighter than that. How does the Pinot – I want to jump right back to Pinot Noir one more time, and then I'm going to move to Chardonnay. I promise I will get to some Chardonnay and some Pinot Gris today. I'm not going to just only focus on Pinot Noir. How does the Pinot Noir in Oregon taste different, say, from California – or from Burgundy, all right? Well, to me, it's kind of a bridge. California Pinots, as a rule, now you can find anything to break a rule, right? I have come up with all kinds of good reasons to break rules. So Pinot Noir, as a rule from California, tends to be very fruity. It has some acidity. It tends to be very fruit-driven, very sometimes even jammy, depending on where it's from. If it's from a very warm region, they'll be flat. They'll be jammy. And by that, I mean some wines that I don't know whether I should drink them or if I should be putting them on toast because they are so fruity. And, you know, people like that. There's nothing wrong with that. I don't like that as well. My personal taste is something that's a little less jammy, a little less fruity. All right. I call it complexity. So I want some layers to my wine. I don't want it to be just all fruit. And it's personal preference. All right. So the wines from California tend to go toward the jammy side or the very fruity side. So you'll smell them and you'll smell. For me, when I smell a glass of wine, sometimes you get straight up strawberries and cherries. All right, and Pinot Noir really focuses on red fruits. And you're like, you know what? When I smell a glass of wine, I smell wine. Okay. Well, how do you describe a iced tea? How do you describe coffee? You know, so try to take some of those descriptors that you use and broaden it a little bit. So, I mean, does it smell like, you know, sometimes it does, though. Like you're just going to pick it up and you could eat the strawberries or you could eat the black cherries or maybe red cherries. Sometimes it does smell that vibrant. Other times it's just the hint. It reminds you of one of those times you smelled cherry pie baking in the oven. You know, so that's what you're looking for are those nuances when you're smelling it. You know, and there are no wrong answers, okay? What you smell, that was probably the best thing somebody told me when I was first learning about wine. And I was at a class. And And there's not that many classes. I was in one for industry people. And the guy up at the front finally says, there are no wrong answers. Who can tell you what you smell? And I was like, you know what? You're right. If I smell Band-Aids and eucalyptus, then that's what I smell. And, you know, it really kind of gave me some confidence. There are no wrong answers. So sometimes just kind of search your brain, close your eyes, and, you know, what does this smell like? What does it remind me of? Every once in a while you're like, I smell coconut. And you're like, okay, now coconut is not normally associated with whatever wine I'm drinking, but I still smell coconut. You know, and there are things that, you know, when you smell, say, Band-Aids, that often, and there is a specific smell, by the way, of, you know, Johnson & Johnson Band-Aids when you open them up. And that's often a sign of a flaw or a fault in the wine. Not always, but sometimes. There's others, too. Sometimes there are wines and I smell fingernail polish remover. And I got to be honest, that is not a pleasant smell, not even when I'm taking off my fingernail polish. But, again, that's a flaw. It's called acetone is almost always what that means, and it means they have something that happened in the winemaking process, and you ended up with too much it's like an alcohol acetone kind of smell, and it's just a flaw. Anyway, back to the Pinot Noir, and I was going somewhere before I got distracted again, but this heartbreak grape has different flavor profiles, and in California, you get that big jamminess. And sometimes you get a little, what we call that, acidity. Remember the sour pickles on the sides? And then you get, you know, the nice smoothness as it goes down your throat. Not a lot of tannin, because remember, it's thin-skinned, so there's not a lot of skin there to create tannin. And, you know, it's just, ooh, ah, beautiful. And that's not true for everything in California, but it is the style that comes out of most regions of California. They tend to be on the fruitier side, all right? You go to Oregon, and they get a little, I call it leaner, all right? So they're not going to be as full in your mouth. And they're not going to explode with fruit and black cherries and pomegranates and cranberries. But you're still going to have some of those same aromas. I mean, I can pick up a glass of Pinot after all these years and be like, you know, it smells like Pinot. And then there are other times I pick up a glass of Pinot and I'm like, I don't know what they did. This doesn't smell like Pinot. You know, and sometimes it's a bad bottle, or sometimes it's just that style. They've tried to move away from it. But when I drink a glass of Pinot Noir, I want it to smell like Pinot Noir. And so, you know, you pick it up from Oregon, and it smells like Pinot Noir. And you get that leanness. You put it in your mouth, and you get that leanness where you get, for me, it just, all of a sudden, it doesn't feel like an explosion, like full, like whole milk. It's a little leaner, maybe more like 1%. So, you know, think about that. All right? Kind of get that concept. And then it's got more acid, those dill pickles along the side of your jaw. Not quite, you know, or a really good balsamic vinegar, right? That's got the sweetness because it's got some age, but it's still got some of that acidity, right? A really good peach. There you go. Really good peach. So you've got the fruit up front, and then you've got some acidity along the side to keep it balanced. All right, so that's what I like in a wine. I like that balance. The other thing about Oregon Pinot Noirs are they're going to have, they come in a couple of different textures. There's one brand that is known, and it's really good. It's not easy to find on the shelf. They're going to run you $30 to about $50 or $60. All right, so it's not Pinot Noir. I'm sorry to tell you this. Pinot Noir doesn't fall into that inexpensive price range at $10 very often. There's a few of them, and I'll tell you a couple of them I like between 10 and 15. Before we quit today, I promise, before we're done today, I'll tell you the ones I like between 10 and 15 that you're going to get good bang for your buck. Most of them tend to be 20 to 40. All right, they're not inexpensive. Keep in mind, it's the heartbreak grape. And when it's coming out of Oregon, you've got all those other problems and not enough land and not enough vines, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They're not going to be cheap, all right? But they are going to be good. They are going to be good. It's the best place to start when you first get into drinking red wine is one of the Pinot Noir family because they're easier on the tannins and the acidity, and they're just beautiful. But let's start with California for those types, all right? But we're back to our Oregon, though. We're staying with Oregon. So those are the flavor profiles you get. And the one, they come in two primary textures for me. Okay, this is me talking. Not everybody always agrees, so this is my opinion. Some of them are silkier, all right? And most of them are what I call velvet, all right? So silk or velvet. I happen to like both fabrics. I think they're amazing. And I'm not talking nylon. I'm talking silk and not satin, which is a knockoff. I'm talking the real deal, all right? When we come back, I'm going to tell you whose wines are silkier, which ones I like the best. I'm also going to tell you a little bit more about how Oregon differs from Burgundy, so you can figure out how the process works. And I promise we're still going to get to Chardonnay and Pinot Gris. We'll be right back.
News, opinion,
hear me.
Your voice counts. Call toll-free 1-866-472-5787. 1-866-472-5787. VoiceAmerica.com.
When you look at something that's been designed, whether it's clothing, architecture, or a work of art, do you stop and wonder about the inspiration and thought process that went into the design? Tune in to Dishing the Dirt on Design with hosts Ann Asher and Eleanor Schrader Schappa. We'll take the mystery out of the creation process, along with revealing the backstory from art to fashion to travel and so much more. Listen to Dishing the Dirt on Design every Wednesday at 4 p.m. Pacific Time, 7 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Variety Channel.
Each week, Jimmy Gould brings you the stories and the people that you want to hear about. Tune in to A Current Life to hear about the journey to success, how our guests became the people they are today, and the highs and lows they experienced along the way. Each hour will leave you inspired and entertained as Jimmy gets up close and personal with every week's guest and shares ideas you can identify with and apply to your own life. A Current Life with Jimmy Gould airs Fridays at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, noon Pacific Time on the Voice America Variety Channel.
Streaming live, the leader in Internet talk radio, VoiceAmerica.com. You are listening to Around the World in a Glass, presented by Sportsman's with your host, Kimber Stonehouse. If you have a question for one of our upcoming programs, please send an email to aroundtheworldinaglass@hotmail.com. That's aroundtheworldinaglass@hotmail.com. Now, back to our show.
All right, so as promised, before I forget again, the silky one that I love so much, and it the first time I ever had it was about 4 or 5 years ago, and we were selling it, and it wasn't selling very well. I was working in a store that was, not a lot of foot traffic. It was a smaller volume store. Didn't have a lot of people coming in and out all the time. And I really wanted to sell this wine because I it was cool. It was new. And so finally I got to try it. And the wholesaler brought by some for me to try. And I was blown away. Absolutely blown away. Because it tasted like silk. It was like silk in my mouth. It was delicate and rich and just reminded me of silk. And the wine is called Patricia Green. Patricia Green out of Willamette Valley. She does just a regular entry level. I think it's called her Reserve. Runs about $29, $30 on the shelf. Some of the others, the old wine is about $40. And then she's got a couple of others that she does that are more expensive. She also does, I think, some whites. Maybe a little Chardonnay, maybe a little Pinot Gris. I can't remember now. We've tasted the whites, but she, like everything else in Oregon, in that Willamette area, the reds are amazing. And so those are the ones that taste the most like silk to me. Others get close, but that one was the one that just blew me away because that was the first time I'd had a wine that I would have called the texture was silk. Some of the others that are velvety, I've mentioned a few of them already. Witness Tree is one of my favorites. I had it in my very first wine job. And to this day, I still love that bottle of wine. It's always a good bottle. If you're going up in price, that one's going to be about $30, $35, all right? Going up in price, I'm a huge fan of the Domaine Drew one I mentioned earlier. I love the Bergstrom. They do a really expensive one, about $60-some dollars a bottle, and it's called Gregory Ranch. It's extremely good. The Hirsch wines, they do a couple of different levels of Pinots, and they're just amazing. They're just good. They do one called Bohendillen, and they have a couple of different Hirsch, and their Chardonnays will flat knock your socks off. We're going to get to that, I promise. We're not out of time yet. And then another one besides Hirsch and Domaine Druin and Bergstrom, I just had another one that I wanted to tell you about that I really like. Domaine Serene. Domaine Serene. They do a Yamhill. I'm not sure how to say that. And it's 30, 35. And then they do some that are even stod and two or three single vineyards. And remember, a single vineyard means that all the grapes come from a small portion of their vineyards. Whereas if it doesn't have a vineyard name on it or a single vineyard name on it, it might come from, you know, their entire vineyard section and then they blend it together. So, you know, when you get, you know, sometimes they'll single out, this vineyard's really awesome. We're going to do this one as a single vineyard. So only the grapes from that vineyard go into that bottling of wine. Just a little trivia there that I don't know that we've ever talked about a whole lot. So that Domaine Serene does some amazing Chardonnays, too. We've got a couple on the shelf. Again, Chardonnay in Willamette Valley is going to be very, very limited. Most of them don't produce a lot of Chardonnay. They focus most of their time and efforts on Pinot Noir. But they do some of these Chardonnays, and they're fantastic. They're going to be very Burgundian style. So they're not going to be heavily oaked. They're not going to do a lot of malolactic fermentation where you get all that butter and cream kind of aromatics, you know, the ones that smell like buttered popcorn and are creamy on the palate. It's not going to have all that. It's going to be a little more acidic. You're going to get more pears and green apples and maybe some tropical notes on the aromas. So you're going to be like, ooh, this is very bright. Makes your mouth kind of water a little bit because it just smells like things that are acidic in your mouth. Anytime I smell green apples, my mouth waters just a little bit because they, when you eat a green apple, they often produce that acidity, right? Those are the type of apples I like, or the ones that have some acidity with the fruity sweetness. And so when you smell that style of Chardonnay, often it'll make you salivate just a little bit because you know it's going to have some acidity, which means for very good food digestion. That's why Pinot Noir and Chardonnay are such fantastic wines to pair with food, because they don't overwhelm your food, but yet they continue to, you know, that there's a balance between the eat and the drink the wine, and the eat and the drink the wine. And so your foods should be rich, and then your wine should provide some acidity so that you want to take the next bite of food, and then that would encourage you to take the next sip of your wine. So it's kind of a trade back and forth, and the better the food pairing, the more amazing it is to switch back and forth between your food and your wine. So those are some of the brands that I have enjoyed, and some of them that I will fork out the $60 for. I mean, I don't do it very often. I live on a budget. I don't do it very often, but I love to be able to go and get out that really good bottle of Chardonnay or that really good bottle of Pinot Noir and enjoy that wine at home. So those are some of them I will spend the extra money on. How is the Oregon wines? How do they differ from Burgundy? Well, I see the Oregon wines as a stepping stone to get to Burgundy because Burgundy wines from France can be very lean, and a little more austere even, depending on the ones. That tends to be their complaint. But it's what most people complain about the most. But the wines aren't always meant to be drunk as young as we drink them. I mean, if it's an 09 vintage and it's a Pinot Noir from Burgundy and you paid $50 for it or $75 for it, you're not supposed to drink that tomorrow. You're not supposed to have that with dinner in 2 hours. It's really meant to be aged a few years, and that kind of tones down the acidity and makes it kind of integrate a little bit more of those flavors. And then the wine is just so much richer when you actually pour it in a glass, say, 3 years later. It's like, holy cow, this wine's amazing. I've told you that I've had some aha moments where I've had really great wine like that. And if you've got the patience and the place to store it properly, it's an amazing experience. But, you know, don't spend a fortune on it until you've had that opportunity to experiment a little bit, and then you can start to invest more money onto laying your wines down if that's something you want to do. So I consider Oregon to be a step. So you kind of get into reds and explore the California region of Pinot Noir and Chardonnay, and then you move into Burgundy, which is a little leaner, a little more complex, just a completely different style. And then as you move out of Burgundy or out of Oregon, you would move into Burgundy. And that's where your wines are going to become even leaner, but even bigger rewards because they're so wonderfully complex. They have many, many layers of minerality and fruit and acidity and finish and textures. You know, it just kind of almost overwhelms the palate because there's so much going on once you're ready for that kind of lean and acidity kind of wines. I've managed to, I think, cover almost everything I wanted to cover. I hope I haven't forgotten anything important. Pinot Gris from Oregon. Let's spend a minute or two talking about that so I don't forget to talk about the Pinot Gris. That's their up-and-coming grape. All right, you will see some Riesling planted in the Willamette Valley, but most of that for future future people are probably not planting as much Riesling. We've got some Riesling that we're pouring by the glass in the bar. We just changed our wine list today, and it's from Pinarache, which is in Willamette. They do an amazing couple of Pinots. I didn't mention them, but I will now because they're very good. The Riesling that they have is from Willamette, but a lot of places that are growing Riesling are doing it more up into the Columbia, Walla Walla Valley, because it thrives up there. You can grow it in cool climate because, I mean, it is in northern Germany. It is in northern France and Germany, Alsace and that area. So it does thrive in cool climates, but it really thrives in a warmer to, you know, so cool nights, warm days kind of climate. It'll really thrive there. And so a lot of Riesling is being grown more now in Washington State. And Walla Walla, which is on the border, and Columbia is on those borders. So that's kind of where Riesling is. But you'll see some from Willamette, and they're very good. They're going to be – now, we've had this conversation before. So Riesling, what was the first thing that came to your mind when you said it? Oh, I don't like Riesling. They're sweet. I don't like Riesling. These Rieslings are not sweet. They are going to be bone dry, and they are so good. So there's fruit. Yes, you're going to smell the fruit. You're going to taste it on the tip of your tongue in the front, right, where we taste fruit and sweet. But then you're going to get hit by all of that acidity on the side, and you're going to be like, whoa, that is awesome, because it's so well-balanced. And Riesling is one of those wines that just goes really well with food every time. If you're doing, you know, vegan fare, vegetarian fare, you're doing salads, you're doing an appetizer that you can't figure out anything that goes with it because it includes artichokes and smoked salmon, asparagus maybe too, you know what? Riesling's your answer. Riesling is just going to go well. I have become a very big fan of Riesling as long as it's well done. Most of the time that means they come from Germany or Alsace. But there's a handful of them coming out of the States that are really darn good. Pinot Gris, I'm going to talk a little bit about that. You guys know it's not my favorite grape. I just don't care for Pinot Gris. It leaves a weird bitterness on my back palate. And occasionally I'll have a wine. We did a blend several years ago. We went up, and a couple of the guys got to go up and blend it at Adelsheim. And Adelsheim did a special bottling for us of our Pinot Gris, and so it had our label on it, and only us, and they do some fantastic wines. So they have I think their Chardonnay is unoaked. They do a dynamite little Pinot Gris. They do Pinot Noir, too, and all of those are going to be 18 to 25, so from the Willamette area, relatively affordable. Everything they do is fantastic. They do some others, too. I've forgotten, I'm sorry to say, which others. I think they do a rosé of Pinot Noir. All of them are good. But I remember their Pinot Gris because I don't necessarily like the regular Pinot Gris. But when they did that blend for us, I don't know what they did. But I had already made up my mind because I didn't get to go, right? So I didn't get to go on the trip that got to pick the wine that we were going to have to sell. Yeah, there's a little bitterness, maybe, just a touch. Anyway, so I didn't get to go, and I don't like Pinot Gris, and I've known that for years. And this was several years ago, and I was determined to not like this wine. I was positive, actually, not even being vindictive about it, that I was probably not going to like this wine that I had to sell, because we are buying the whole thing, and it's like 30-some-odd cases or 40, and I'm going to have to sell this wine, and I don't even like Pinot Gris. Whose idea was this? Oh, yeah, I think I was in on that decision. But anyway, I kind of already figured I wouldn't like it. But I just wanted to taste it and make sure that, you know, who I could sell it to. Because a very important part of selling wine is understanding its flavor profile. And I liked it. It was really, really good. In fact, I bought a bottle for myself. I've long since drank it. But I was stunned because here all of a sudden was a Pinot Gris. It was blended, but it was a Pinot Gris, and I liked it. So now I still try them, and my team will rave about them. We've got another Pinot Gris on the wine list. I think it's from Oregon. They were like, oh, Kimber, you got to try this. We tried it while you were gone. Well, you got to try this Pinot Gris. It's so good. They were all excited. I tried it, and I'm like, yeah, tastes like Pinot Gris. You know, it just doesn't wow me. And I know there's a lot of you out there that like it. I sell a lot of Pinot Gris, and I can tell you which ones and how they taste. I promise I can sell you good Pinot Gris. I just don't want you to have to make me drink it because I don't really like them very well. And the Pinot Gris that they've picked for the wine list, yeah, it's good. I just don't really like it very well. All right, we've got some cool stuff coming up in the coming weeks. So I think I've covered everything for Oregon wines. If I forgot something important, if I forgot your favorite winery, do write in and tell me. I'll be happy to mention it at some future date when we're talking about Pinot Noir and Oregon and Pinot Gris. If you must. No, I'm kidding. Do feel free to write in and tell me about your favorite stuff and what I forgot that was so very important, because I always forget things. But we've got some cool stuff coming up. The whole month of December, we are spending on booze. I think some of the posts are already up. I think I've sent in most of the descriptions already, because I was really trying to plan ahead. Our store goes really crazy. So if you do need anything at the store, come by and see us. Give us a call and, of course, email through sportsmanswine.com. Anything like that would be awesome. We respond to all of three of those methods of communication at the store. So if you've got a question or you need something shipped here in Phoenix, you need something shipped to a state that it's legal to ship to, you want to call and say hi. You know, all of these things are acceptable. So, you know, feel free to reach out to us at the store through the holidays when the panic situation hits. You don't have to wait to get your answer on the air if that's taken too long. But we are going to be doing scotch. I've got something planned for tequila. I have got your holiday hangover cures coming. That's going to be one of them we're going to do in the next coming weeks. So we've kind of got those planned, and, you know, take a look on the website and make sure you tune in. So hopefully they will help you through your gift giving in the next several weeks so that there's not as much panic as maybe there has been in the past. If you've got a difficult menu to plan, or you need some party wine, make sure you come see us at the store. We'll be happy to help sort you out your menu. And we will also be happy to help you with party wine and find you the best bang for the buck. And, you know, sometimes stuff people don't realize is inexpensive. Oh, I was going to tell you my favorite wines, favorite Pinots for $10 to $15. All right, quick, because I've got like 30 seconds. Bogle Pinot Noir from California. Excellent. Hahn, also from California. Hahn Santa Lucia, I think is where it's from. But anyway, it is absolutely amazing. It's $14 a bottle. The Bogle is more like $12. All right. Those are two. I like the Underwood Pinot from Oregon. And again, $12, $13 a bottle. It's not as good as the Hahn. I think the Hahn, if I had to pick one, the Hahn is my pick every time. It's just that darn good. One more, Ballard Lane, if you can find it. That one's a harder one to find, but Ballard Lane, is also another good one. And it runs, I don't know, $12, $13. So those would be my picks. If I'm buying Pinot for under 15, you can bet it's going to be the Hahn Pinot every time. It's good. It's rich. It's complex. Plenty of fruit, good balance. You know what? I think I might have to take one home tonight. It's a great way to end the day. All right. Until next week, make sure you have a little Pinot Noir this week. Maybe something from Oregon if you can find it and afford it. Until next time, cheers.
Thanks again for tuning in. Around the World in a Glass is heard every Wednesday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, 12 noon Pacific Time on the Voice America Variety Channel. Please join Kimber Stonehouse from Sportsman's Fine Wines and Spirits next week for another glass.